Hello and welcome to AgTech So What. I'm Sarah Nolette, with a bit of a cold. It's been a busy time for us here at Tenacious, and just last week, our whole team got the chance to get out of town and onto the farm. And not just any farm either. We visited Jigsaw Farms, home to sheep farmer and longtime friend of the show, Mark Wooden and his wife Eve, who updated us on their vision for, quote, sustainable intensification as an alternative to regenerative agriculture. Visiting farms and learning directly from farmers is definitely one of the coolest parts of our job. It's an incredible opportunity to challenge our own thinking about who customers, users, beneficiaries, and even visionaries are when it comes to ag tech. What's more, visiting farmers creates opportunities to understand the evolution of our ideas, to check their staying power, and to test and learn how our hypotheses need to change alongside people, landscapes, and markets. In that spirit, this week, while we're taking a break to work on some new content that we're really pumped about, we wanted to revisit our original conversation with Mark, which was published back on July 15th, 2020. Since then, a lot has changed, and as we visited the farm and revisited the discussion, I found some new insights, especially in light of developments in carbon markets, the continued rising star of regenerative agriculture, and evolving consumer and investor perspectives on livestock production. And I think you will too. Our chat started, as our hardest core fans may remember, with a bit of context about Mark's very unusual background.
I was actually raised in South Korea and in the 1960s. I just turned 60 a month ago, so that dates me. My parents were missionaries in South Korea, and as a very small child, no matter whichever country we lived in, they'd always find me in a pigsty or wherever the animals were. So I was always heading towards ag, even though I have non-farming parents. I suppose that gave a strong emphasis for a social justice type background, having been brought up in a missionary, although I'm actually an atheist, and that imprinted on me. And then we moved all around different parts of the world. And then we settled in Melbourne for my secondary schooling. And then once I finished that, I went and started working on farms and didn't have enough capital to get started for what we wanted to do. So I realized I had to get another income. Went back to university when I was 23 and did a geography degree and ended up teaching for 10 years, secondary here and in Africa, actually.
While in Melbourne, Mark and his wife Eve started the family. At one time, they had four kids under 6 years old. But the pull to get into agriculture never went away.
We always had small properties in Gippsland when we were teaching and stuff, just running vealers and a few sheep. And then we decided to go for scale. We were very fortunate. We came up here in 1996. We started purchasing and bought all our land pre the MIS Blue Gum schemes. And we were fortunate that we could buy large swaths of land at relatively low cost. We had a very simple formula. We realized to be within 2 hours of a capital city was going to knock us out from being competitive at a scalable agriculture level, and we were always attracted obviously to grazing and livestock, and so the choices sort of chose themselves, to be frank with you.
Right. I've got a million questions, not least of which is how you became an atheist, but I suppose we can save that for maybe a different podcast or a chat over a beverage. But when you, I guess, tell me about the operation today, like give us a paint us a bit of a picture of where it's at.
Jigsaw Farms, as it's now called, has changed in size a few times since Mark and Eve first started.
We shrunk slightly a few years ago when I had a health issue. I had a heart operation, and after that we made a decision that we had to make a sustainable lifestyle. We got to about 16,500 acres, and we're employing 9 people and running about 35,000 ewes and nearly, up to about 1,600 breeding cattle. And we made a decision when land prices improved that part of our succession plan was to shrink, which was slightly unusual when everyone else was growing. But we still have significant size.
Today, the farm is about 8,500 acres across 2 blocks. But despite changes in size, their focus at the core remains the same.
We grow grass. It's that simple. Since we've purchased the properties, we've measured the outcome. We've doubled the food and fibre on a per hectare basis off all the properties we've bought, and in some instances 3 or 4 times. We're a high input system, so we use fertiliser strategically and in a quite a precision way. We have sort of 8 different blends going out, and we've come back to where we stabilise. We join 20,000 Merino ewes to either a terminal sire or for self-replacing. We've got good fertility now, mainly through selecting for muscle and fat. And we've got about, what are we calving down? I think we're calving down 690 crossbred cattle as well. So that keeps us busy.
Over time, Mark has made a lot of non-traditional and in some cases, perhaps controversial decisions on the farm.
This year we'll have ceased all mulesing, and we did a number of years as a transition. We did the cryogenetic freeze branding as a transitional technology, which we finished using last year because we're happy with where at genetically where we're at.
There are a few reasons Mark decided to go down this path, a path that involved a range of technologies.
Well, it was twofold, really. One was, I suppose, the pull factor was there was a market premium for completely non-treated, including freeze branding product like the ZQ program for the wool. And there was also a push factor that we were happy that we can manage the risk of not having any treatment in terms of the breach of the animal after moving through the freeze branding gave us a fair bit of protection and safety until we were confident that genetically we were strong enough that we were our sheep were plain enough that we weren't at a high risk. We're still at risk from fly, but we've also got the technology. We've got an electrode type system, which isn't that fancy, but it means that we can process if we have to jet sheep very quickly in large numbers.
So the original driver was there's a premium out there, and then you figured out how to make it work. Is that right?
No, the original driver was probably not either of those things. The original driver was an animal welfare basis. We really were unhappy with mulesing, and we also could smell the smoke coming. That's when we started selecting genetically for a non-mule sheep, 2010. So you know we're on that 10-year line now of doing it.
One of our previous podcast guests, Mark Ferg Ferguson, back in episode 60, actually played a role in Jigsaw's transition away from mulesing, helping especially on the genetic side. But like many adopters of technologies and new practices, it wasn't something that Mark just jumped into in one go. He had a plan and made small, measured changes over time.
I've looked pretty heavily at some of the market forces that are at play. Whether it's a social license or whether it's a price premium, I think the two tend to run together because one may reflect others, or there might be a time lag between the two. But we also had the practicality of actually running a decent-sized commercial flock with risk of flies in an Australian environment. When we felt that confidence going forward, we obviously did it. We've done trials every year where it isn't like we've just gone wholesale bang. And this last year we ceased at the Helmview, the Melville Forest properties completely and treatment, and we got through the summer and we were pretty confident, and then this year we've decided to go to do the whole thing, whereas we're not actually doing it at all in terms of the freeze branding. We have a mules to sheep here for, this would be nearly coming up to our fifth year. So we haven't done a mulesing since then. So there'd be one age group, maybe one and a half age groups, if that makes sense, that have got mulesing on them on the property, and that would be it.
Another pretty big initiative that Mark has taken on at Jigsaw is going carbon neutral. Again, I was interested in the drivers. What made Mark decide to go down this path?
Well, I chaired the Climate Institute for 12 years from 2005, and it was Sydney-based, and I spent a lot of my life going back and forth to there, which probably wasn't good for my carbon footprint. And I was heavily involved in, some of the some of the solutions to do with climate change. And it became pretty self-evident that as a community we needed to act, and as a world, as a globe, we needed to act, but also as individuals we needed to act. And so it seemed somewhat hypocritical if we were meat producers here, which have got a fair carbon footprint on them, that we didn't actually look at how we manage our own farms in that context. We've always been heavily into shelter belts in trees and agroforestry for high-value saw log production. And so Melbourne Uni actually approached us, and we worked with them on doing a full audit of our carbon footprint using predominantly the grass grow models. But it was a quite exhausting one. It's actually been peer-reviewed and published through CSIRO, the paper now. And we achieved carbon neutrality here in 2011. And that's predominantly by having about 18% of the farms down to trees for saw logs or for permanent revegetation shelter belts. And so the motivation was there, but we had to sort of saying, I think we're there, and using some of the perhaps the simpler tools but not quite as accurate tools, we went through the full process. I would not encourage anyone to do it. It's a quite an arduous process and not necessarily a commercial reward one.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, because it sounds like the audit, the initial verification, the baselining, and even some of those practices can potentially be seen as detrimental to profits. How do you think about the kind of return on investment of these kinds of programs and practices?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you have to look at it in a whole systems perspective. I mean, in terms of whole farm planning, I always say, you know, like we've obviously been doing it for quite a few years now, but when we have a tour group of people come through and they go, well, what should I do? How do I do it? Well, I say make a plan. And then in some good years you can invest in it and some years you can't. And you need to understand where you're going in terms of your plan. And that may be generational that they get to that plan. It may not even be in that generation. But just make sure that what you're doing won't have to be undone by someone else further along the line. And from a whole systems point of view, I think that's what we did our decisions on. I mean, we were, first and foremost, we value biodiversity. My wife's a really keen bird nut. We started here with our bird surveys in the beginning in 96, having 48 bird surveys, and now we've got 48 bird species, and now we have 164 bird species, and that's a very good environmental indicator of what we're doing. In terms of your other question, in terms of the economic reward, well, we're in a strong position, really, where if we do elect to actually sell our product through a carbon neutral scheme, which is a scalability is our issue because, you know, how do you do it? We're in a strong position where we can put our hands in our hearts and quite legitimately say, well, here's a study that CSIRO's peer-reviewed. There's rigour in the system, but there's also, you know, you sleep pretty good at night. You know, and we're producing these, you know, in Australian context, about 10% of our greenhouse gases are produced by ruminant animals. Sheep are about 4% of the total footprint. And in that context, it's a really useful thing that we, you know, we can say, well, we've got part of the solution worked out. Although I should say, I think the solution for most people isn't the trees. I think most of it's going to be about feed efficiency and looking at a ruminant change going forward, whether that's using feeds or whether it's using some of the inhibitor or some of the injections that you could use going forward.
Mm. And so when you, I guess just to break that down a little bit, so you guys did it because it was, you felt the right thing to do. And when the uni came along to do that initial audit, did they, like, is that something you had to pay for and you kind of sunk a cost into this knowing that there would eventually be a benefit or?
No, they were pretty keen to do it too because we didn't know in a high rainfall area and they didn't know how it would work. I mean, part of the thing was just straight inquisitiveness, to be honest with you. Like, you know, we thought we were going to be there, but by the time you put your energy and your fuel and you're looking at, for us, like in the drought period in 2005 and 6, we had to move down. We had 2,600 breeders on this one block, which we had to take account for from a methane point of view. And if you actually ever looked at the graph, you've got this amazing rise at that period, and you had to. But that's real farming. You know, real farming is movement and trading and bringing things in, and some good years and some bad years, and you know where you need to. You've got excess feed, and you've got not enough feed, and all of that had to be done over a number of years. So they were pretty keen to do it as well. So, and they've now working with the MLA for beef farmers. They're running out a much simpler form using some of the stuff we used for 50 different farms in Australia. So again, that's a much easier tool for people to do. And the challenge now is for the sheep industry, to be honest, is to hook into it. And there's no arguments in the sheep industry. Well, there's probably is that I don't hear, but you know, most people in the sheep industry are happy to understand at least what the problem is. And so it's just a question of us actually getting the data.
When you say the problem, you mean in terms of emissions, or what do you mean by the problem?
Do I understand what so you know, if you know, well, MLA have signed off for 2030 red meat industry in Australia will be carbon neutral. Well, between you and I, we've got 10 pretty tough years to achieve that. It's not, you know, there's actually today the Beef Sustainability Framework releases their annual data coming forward, and they're talking about a drop in emissions again, and the drop going forward. But what they sneakily declined to say is the herd size shrunk. And that's the biggest driver of dropping our emissions in Australia at the moment, is that we don't have as many mouths around, and we've been through a massive drought period through large swathes of the country that grow beef. So, you know, just to be frank with you, it is a challenge.
One of the areas Mark is looking to next is on the feed side, both reducing emissions and improving feed efficiency.
We've got an opportunist feedlot containment area here where we hold about anywhere up to 7,000 lambs, and we can do a fair bit of measurement now, particularly with having an EID system where we can measure growth per animal, and we can look at some of these inhibitors, food we put into the mixes, whether it's a seaweed-based one or whatever, which can change the methane behaviour. And quite positively, putting aside, even if you don't accept any of the climate change or any of the social licence argument, if it's about feed efficiency and you can put more kilos on per animal for the mouth feed you put down the throat, that's going to be pretty attractive to people, I think.
Yeah. I guess that's what I was trying to get my head around, Mark, is if you broke up the categorized the different changes you've made, what's the breakdown between didn't know but were just curious versus thought there would be a environmental or kind of societal benefit, even if it would be a cost to the bottom line, versus thought there'd be a premium versus thought there'd be a private benefit, as in, you know, you guys would make more money or get more profit, not through a premium or a scheme, but because it's just better practices. I guess if there's those four categories, how does it break down in terms of what were the drivers?
It's a very, very good, but very difficult question, Sarah.
Oversimplifying or overcomplicating?
No, I'm not sure. But to be honest with you, if I was going to be honest with you, it's probably all of those things, and it's all changed over time. I mean, you know, like there are times when you do things for the pure, if we'd had good years and financially we could afford to go a bit harder in terms of, you know, doing offset trees or the, you know, I'm a wood nut too. I love timber. So, you know, the saw log timbers have an intrinsic value but also an economic value. I mean, our trees, when we harvest them after a 25-year rotation, are going to challenge any of the sheep production for returns. I mean, they're going to be over $20,000 net return per hectare. But the problem is you have no income in that 25-year block. So, you know, it's all about having that within the landscape. So when we put those trees in, they were based on the desire to have a diverse income, superannuation outcomes, succession planning, all those number type things, but they're also, we like trees. So, you know, that's using two of those four categories in that decision. In terms of some of the carbon neutrality expectation, well, we didn't have the technologies where we could reduce the methane on those animals, although we did recognise by running a higher input system, and this is one of the challenges for some of the regen ag people, by actually producing your emissions intensity per kilos produced as a measurement tool, these high input systems very often outgun them on their methane. You know, if you've got an extensive low input system, you need to somehow equate that methane per kilo, whether it's per lamb or per wool kilo, whatever the criteria you're using, and that's one of the challenges. So we were confident that by doing that, by being economies of scale and being highly efficient, we were going to make money out of it. It was going to do it, but at the same time, we were conscious that it had to reduce that carbon loading per kilo. So again, that's two of your categories. And in my brain, when we were talking about it, I'm not sure how I separate that, to be honest with you.
It sounds like not much of it, though, was in the market premium or kind of some other reward category.
I think the discretionary market premiums, there's a bit in wool. We've done a little bit there with wool with some carbon neutral products going through where we had to track them from farm gate to, it was a Quattro, it was a sportswear brand hitting an Italian shop. And we had to do an offset there, and that was to understand it. But it was tickling on the edges. It's not a serious one there. The language now is that consumers post-COVID are going to be a lot more discretionary, understanding the wool market I'm reading now is there's people are going to buy less wool, they're going to buy better wool, they're going to buy what's it called, ageless fashion items, all of that, which is, you know, if that comes to fruition, then I think we will be in a strong position. So the other half of the question, which you sort of inferred without asking directly, is it also protects us in these markets going forward. So even though the opportunity isn't perhaps there now for the market premium, oh, there's a little bit on the fringes, there is a market premium on animal welfare issues. Just look at ZQ. I mean, that's a pretty straightforward one there. There's clear market premium. But on those other aspects, say it's a biodiversity question, you know, whether it's a naturalness, which is one of the other categories, which I never quite understand what it means, or whether it's on a carbon basis, those markets going forward are not going to disappear. They can only grow. But how much are they going to grow by? I don't know. But by doing what we did again in that whole systems approach and on a whole farm basis, I think we've set ourselves up to have more opportunities to enter those markets than if we didn't. So it's a sort of a double negative, really, isn't it? We did it because what could happen, but it may not happen. But the trends are pretty – trend. I'm a trend person. I look at trends.
You mentioned Regen Ag. The narrative can sometimes be really oversimplified, right? Well, if we just farmed better, then consumers would be rewarded and we could save the environment, and why doesn't everyone just do it? And we'll call it regenerative and everyone will be happy. And I think that misses all of the nuances that you've just started to get into.
Well, there's an implication too that, if to be brutal, is what we're doing is not regenerative. I mean, if you look at our carbon stores, which we measure rigorously, we get to about 4% and then it doesn't move much at all from then. So then they say, oh, you've got to look at your soil biologies and you're going to have to look at rotation. Well, we rotationally graze. We do a range of different grazing systems and we just can't move it. Our biggest change of getting locked in carbon here was not using fertilizer. It was going to a perennial system. As soon as we went to a perennial system away from using annuals, we started locking carbon up. And I would argue that, you know, by us doubling the, you know, we grow, our farms here are double the district average in terms of carrying capacity. And that means that, A, we can do the offsets with the trees and still make good money. Our profitability here is, you know, we'll be frank, we've had on average an over 10% net return every year. And part of that's capital gain built into it because it's gone off. It's actually a lot higher than that at the moment, but that's a falsity because our land prices have just gone ballistic of late because of the security of water we have here. But, you know, I mean, it's a robust system which is, you know, like if we are going to feed 10 million people in the world and we are going to have to produce protein for them, Regen Ag's not going to cut it. It's just not going to be able to do it. It's not going to have the – we're going to have to look at some of the more intense systems being kinder to the environment, having a higher level of social license in terms of whether it's a toxicity, you know, with their pesticides or whether it's water usage or whether it's a carbon conversion, whatever criteria you use. We're going to have to get good at this. And you asked my question before, you're interested why I'm an atheist. Well, I'm an atheist when it comes to Regen Ag. I think that is an evangelical movement. And I think that they need to come up with the science. And they keep coming. And I keep saying, send me the science that shows me, peer-reviewed science that shows me the outcome. And not one of them has produced it yet. Not one. And they all say they can't do it because of the money that's in the big ag. Well, they need to get their act together because it's a distraction, as far as I'm concerned, to where the industry should be moving.
It's really interesting because in some ways, if you step back and look at the principles of regenerative ag, one of which might be not in any kind of doctrinal sense, but in what we want for the outcome, or what they or whoever it is, what Regen wants for the outcome, you know, carbon neutral, I imagine, and high animal welfare are two that are up high in the top three or five or two. And so in some ways do you think it's a labeling question? Like, you're already doing it. You're getting the outcomes, but they've either over or under prescribed the practices to get there, and that's where the challenge is.
Well, that was interesting. As before, we got the Rona got us. I was going to talk about Lamex on, and they said on Regen Ag, and there was a presumption that I'd actually have a crack at them, which I would have. But my opening was going to be pretty simple. I'm a regenerative agricultural participant here, and I don't like that name being taken away from what we do. And you, just because you use that name regularly, you need to define and prove and support your cause. If you, and then they'll go off on tangents. I'll go, okay, well, let's talk about carbon. I'll go, bang, bang. Let's talk about biodiversity. And we've got so much data on biodiversity because we've had, you know, Deakin Uni, everyone's done every water invertebrate and every bloody thing coming through here in terms of measurement. And that's what we do is clearly positive for the environment in any senses of the word. And I would challenge even some of those regen people to come and beat our data in terms of outcome to the environment or outcome in terms of native flora or fauna, whatever the criteria they use. And yet we can still produce double the amount of food and fiber and not damage the environment, clearly not. We are regenerating what was here in a cleared landscape full of onion grass. You know, I mean, the language is, you know, they take the space and all of a sudden that becomes, well, they must be doing regeneration because they're using the term. And I challenge them that that's not right. I am regenerating our agricultural landscape here.
Yeah. You mentioned I guess one thing that strikes me is how complex the measures are of what you're doing. Like if you went to someone who's doing some of these things or not any of them and said, you know, we've got to get biodiversity to here and carbon to here. And even if you had all the measurements and someone believed in the philosophy of getting there and saw the profitability, like there's still a gap in how you would do that. Possibly even a worse before better in terms of like how you would, like it's expensive to measure that stuff. Some of those changes might cost the bottom line on the way. How do you think about, you know, getting more people there?
And I think that's where, as an industry, we probably need to simplify the system. And that's why when Richard Eckhart's working with MLA on these 50 ready reckoners for your carbon footprint with 50 practical beef farmers, I think that's great because they'll push back, they'll have robust data. If you can't sit down with a tool and enter it in on a Excel type approach, it might not be Excel, but type approach, and you can't put your data in there in a day, people are not going to take it up. It just has to be a practical thing, and then it has to be robust to be defensible that to the industry that this has been done properly. And I mean, that's the same with all the animal welfare and all the QA stuff we do. You know, we need to be able to show, you know, that we are euthanizing. We're about to start using numb nuts for our when we mark the lambs, for example. And, you know, we will be able to go and we'll go, if you want us to test, here's the receipt, here's the, you know, of what we've done. And that's the rigor we need to do in the system and the QA. But it has to be done. And maybe with the biodiversity side, you pick two or three indicators. I mean, you know, Birds Australia are now running all these little transects all around Australia on all these different farms with enormous amount of data, which is just using, you know, predominantly, you know, competent but amateur bird watchers. And, you know, like if you get enough data, it becomes robust. I mean, you have someone dodgy in there saying they've seen X or Y, but if it's a repeatability and you do it every 3 months and it's in this area, that's a good one. So farmers could use that.
I challenged Mark a bit on this because I guess I'm still a little bit skeptical about building a tool that's both comprehensive enough to stack up on the science and still easy to use for farmers.
Even if it was the simplest Excel tool to measure all the, but you've got 17 of them, you got the biodiversity one, you got the carbon one, you got the welfare one, and there's this scheme for this state and this scheme for that state. And if none of them are giving you a reward today, I struggle to see why anyone, even if they're the simplest tools, why anyone fills them out.
Well, I suppose it gets back to your motivation and why you farm. But I mean, I think a lot of farmers are naturally quite inquisitive. It's a strange industry, really. We're competitors with each other, but we're great collaborators with each other. We're involved in the New Zealand, the farm mapping exercise. We're doing the grazing program now. And to do that, we need to get better with our rigor with our pasture assessment. So we've just bought one of those electronic plate wands where you go around, it's connected to your Bluetooth, and you put it over the grass, and basically it gives you a height, and then you do enough measurements in the paddock and you get the data. So we're using that. And so what will happen is, and people will come and they'll go, oh, why are you using that? And we'll talk about it. And then they'll adapt it. And I reckon the same as with your other question. If you can get the language in the place where people will go, why are these indicators? And the Sheep Sustainability Framework has a lot of indicators going to come out in the next few months on all these things you talk about. You could report on it as an industry-wide, or you could also report as a farm basis on those indicators. Now, you may say, I only want to chase the animal welfare premium, so all I'm choosing is that box. That's cool. I'm not worried. You might want to do the enviro ones. You're looking at protection. It might be about biodiversity. It might be about water quality. It might be, depending where you are in the Australian landscape, it might be about irrigation. That's cool too. So I don't think there is one set that will suit everybody. But again, we're free market people here. You can select which ones you do or none at all. And then as long as you have that knowledge, you may use that knowledge and at least gives you some, when a premium comes along, you can do like us and you go, okay, we're going to go that way. I'm just saying the technology can fit in with some of those measurement things, which make us a bit easier. But also you need to own some of the decisions you're making of what you see as valuable for your farm. And I think in Australia, if I was in Queensland, I would have a whole different set of matrices than what I do in Southern Victoria.
That's one of the challenges, is like a system that like came in from the top that said all farmers thou shalt whatever, like it's just not going to work because for all the reasons that you've said.
The sheep sustainability framework is the opposite of that. It's totally saying here's a whole bunch of indicators we're going to judge ourselves as an industry by, and obviously we need to have measurement tools to do them. And some of them, to be honest with you, we don't have very good measurement tools now. And like the beef sustainability framework, they don't have them now. And they're going, we still know that consumers are asking these questions about our product, but we don't know how we're going to measure it. But we're leaving it there as a desirable thing, and we're trying to work out how we're going to measure it. And I think that's been totally transparent with people, and I think that's a really useful thing.
For Mark, a big key to industry-wide change and to helping farmers balance the practical realities with some of these perhaps aspirational schemes will be technology.
If you live in Victoria and you're a sheep producer, you have to use EID now. So I was anti-EID when it first came in. I thought it was an impost on us we didn't need. And now I'm the biggest advocate you'll ever see. Partly because it is a really useful tool. I mean, I think the challenge for us is now we've got what every individual sheep identified is to utilise that technology, and like particularly for us, like for weight gain in our feedlot, we used to have these passengers, they'd be on a 21 or a 28 or a 35-day feed regime, and some of them went through two or three of those feeds around because they kept on taking out, they didn't meet market specs, and they obviously weren't doing. Now we know who they are, they can go. If they're not going to do it after that for whatever reason, they're gone. They go off as a store lamb, off they go. And that's the beauty of some of those technologies. And it's such a, you know, you just have a reader there, it gives you weight gain. We have, you know, a couple of our young blokes here, they love it. They engage more in the workplace because they're using technology and they're so much quicker at it than I. It's just they're wired to it, you know, and so there's that sort of thing. I know this electronic plate meter, which we've just got, they're going to get excited by that because instead of us driving off and all us guessing how much feed or quality is in the paddock, we've actually got a tool which we'll use to calibrate their visual reads all the time, which is great. It's just a Bluetooth to your phone. It's that simple. I mean, so some of that's pretty, you know, good. But, I mean, our stock records are still on Excel. I mean, you know, like we're a long way from where we should be on some of this. But, you know, it's still useful.
When you look back, Mark, over the since you've been farming, tell me about your best year and your worst year or toughest decisions that you made.
Oh, well, the worst is easy. And although positively, the worst 2 years I had were the two drought years in early 2000s. I learnt more in each of those years than I had in the 20 years around them. For sure, or 25 years around them, because that was all about making decisions when you had the least resource. We dropped $1.8 million in the first year and 1.2 in the second year, and we made a decision which in hindsight we kept too much stock too early. And so one of the challenges for us going forward is to have more flex in our system, which was one of the learnings from there. So we make decisions early. It's all about, we don't try to pick the top of the market or the bottom of the market. We try to make decisions. You know, last year we sold, when the autumn break hadn't come, we sold probably too many sheep than we should have, but it just made us get through winter. We need to be able to sleep at night, and we're still profitable, but it's about using the, you know, we even though the three-month weather forecast is not the most reliable tool, it's still on the basis, I always say, well, it's better than using nothing. So we need to use those, and that those decision points in our one were those learnings from those drought years, and we've tried to keep where we have more flex in our system. And that's reflected in our breeding objectives. I mean, we have a true dual purpose ewe now that can go to a terminal, or it can go back to a merino. If wool stays where it is at the moment, we will make the decision to join more to terminals next year than we have this year. But because of where we're at with that flexibility, we can do that. You know, you just go buy some more terminal rams. It's pretty straightforward. But then there are consequences, obviously, further on. The best years we've had. Probably the best years are not necessarily my most favourite years. It's in the development and the design of wetlands and water systems and, you know, planning. I'm a geographer. I mean, that's my training. I love land. I love landscape. I love fencing to land type. I really enjoy, you know, how do you design a paddock so you utilise more of the food on offer at all times. How do you design laneway systems, which mean that it's efficient to move stock around? I mean, we have 50,000 DSCs and we have 4.5 staff. You know, I mean, it's a very efficient operation, and they paid well, and their staff are the most valuable thing we do is our staff. And that's, you know, one of the learnings we've got in that best year was how do we look at what was there? And a lot of it is about people. You know, it's not about the weather or the financial. It's about you want to get out of bed and you want to go to work because you want to work with those people and they want to work with you. And you feel active and they, you know, they're not looking at their clock and they don't get to 4:30 or 5 and thinking where do they want to be. And that cultural stuff are my best years. You know, if I was going to do it ever again from the beginning, my advice to everyone is if you can't manage people, perhaps this isn't the industry for you. You need to be, it is a people industry.
So much of this conversation with Mark still resonates. I continue to be impressed with how Mark strikes a balance between the personal and social imperatives for different activities, from regenerating landscapes, practicing agroforestry and improving biodiversity, to eliminating practices like mulesing that are bad for animal welfare, all while keeping an eye on trends and where there might be a potential to access premiums. His experience of skepticism towards the regen ag mainstream is telling, I think, given how many people are now talking about how agriculture ties to climate outcomes. I find Mark's methods and data compelling, whether it's his exhaustive carbon footprint accounting or the impressive number of birds and other biodiversity we saw when visiting the farm. But I can also see criticisms of sustainable intensification as well. My experience tells me that everything has its limits, and for high intensity, that might be time. I think the right answer is probably where Mark lands in the end, that farmers, like entrepreneurs, investors, consumers, well, all of us, are obligated to own the decisions we make. A willingness to go against the grain has been a hallmark of Mark's career in ag, and he's found success doing it, and he's happy to share his experiences. But he's not evangelical. He's not on a mission to turn Jigsaw into a demonstration farm that fuels a global agrarian revolution. He's found what works for his family, his business, and his landscape, and he encourages others to do the same. I'm still left with questions, of course. I wonder whether Mark's resistance to the word regenerative makes sense in a world where consumers are obsessed with the term and have a relatively simplistic view of what it means. I also wonder how much government-provided incentives are playing into Mark's decision-making, and whether if those incentives were to change or be removed, it would lead to significant changes in Mark's management practices. From the perspective of the future habitability of our planet, I also wonder how rare Mark is, and how realistic it is to expect that most farmers will be as forward-thinking, innovative, and risk-tolerant as he, a first-generation farmer, is. Building technology, especially climate technology, for the Marks of the world in ag, I worry, will be pretty hard to scale. If you're hungry for even more insights from Mark, make sure to check out our 100th episode, where we had a brief check-in with him from the fall of 2021. For now, though, that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thanks again to our guest, Mark Wooten of Jigsaw Farms. And of course, thank you for listening. For more information on any of the resources mentioned in the podcast, visit our website, agtechsowhat.com. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.